Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Hello. We're going to continue our study in the book of Numbers today. We're going to be dealing with a literary unit that runs from Numbers 16 through 17. It's basically known as the Korath Rebellion, and it basically deals with the rebellion of Korah. It's a continuing, I guess it's like the theme of the book of Numbers, and that is that the people of God rebelled against God's leadership and thereby rebelling against God. The people's frustration at not being able to enter the promised land, the people's frustration at going through the desert is now manifesting itself in open rebellion against God's chosen anointed leadership. So let's look, if we could, at number 16. Now Korah, and then it lists his family here all the way back to Levi. Even a fuller example of this family tree can be seen in Exodus chapter 6, verses 16 through 25. Some have assumed that there is some jealousy on the part of this family, for as you know from other accounts, it's going to be the rebellion of Korah and some of the sons of Reuben. Now if you look at how they're positioned around the tabernacle, both Reuben and in the inner circle, Korah's family, are going to be on the south side. Their tents would be right together when they camped. There seems to be an implication that Korah may have been jealous. Obviously, he was related to Moses and Aaron. We're not exactly sure how. Maybe a cousin. Maybe he was jealous and wanted to be a priest. That's one of the options, because Moses is going to accuse him of that. Do you want to now be a priest too? It's going to be found in verse 10 of chapter 16. Others, I think, have said that Reuben is jealous because it's the firstborn son, but seemingly the place of preeminence has gone to Judah. And so here we have two groups, for maybe their own reasons, are rebelling against the leadership of Moses and Aaron. Korah was a part of the tribe of Korath that was responsible for carrying the furniture of the ark. Next to the priests, they're one of the most important groups in all the people of God. Kind of reminds me of a Satan who was apparently an archangel, but was so close to God that by being so close caused him to be jealous. The same thing seems to be involved here. Now, you know, you can be the tribe of Levi took the place of the firstborn of Israel as especially dedicated to God. Now, of the tribe of Levi, the family of Aaron became priest, and all the other Levites were ministers in the temple. Then it mentions some other families here, Dathan and Abiram, which, and also are mentions the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth. It's kind of unusual that On is only mentioned here. He's not mentioned anywhere else in the Bible. Not in the family tree of Reuben, not in the rest of this account. We're not real sure why On is mentioned here. But they are sons of Reuben. If you want to see the lineage of the sons of Reuben, you might want to look at Numbers 26, 4 through 11. And they rose up before Moses, together with some of the sons of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, chosen in the assembly, men of renown. Now that shows that the rebellion was not just this one group of Levites and not just this particular family of Reuben, but it involved 250 other leaders. Now when it says men of renown, apparently this means they were chosen in the assembly. It shows some of the levels of leadership within the people of God. These would have been men who everybody knew their names. These were tribal leaders. Now apparently they want to be priests, because these 250 are going to hold censers before the Lord. Now, Reuben, the children of Reuben did not want to be priests. They just wanted someone else to be in control. And they assembled together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You have gone far enough. For all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord is in the midst. So why do you exalt yourself above the assembly of the Lord?" Now, you know, I think I've used that argument myself. That's a pretty good argument. I think Ephesians chapter 4 seems to talk about that all believers are ministers. But what this seems to imply is that God has especially chosen some to be leaders of His people. And though I do believe that all of Israel was holy, Exodus 19, 4, 5, and 6, you are a peculiar treasure. You are a kingdom of priests. All of them were priests in a sense. All of them were chosen in a sense. All of them, quote, were ministers in a sense. But God had some special leadership. So I think what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to balance God's special chosen leaders against the holiness of the people of God. They were emphasizing one half of a truth. I guess half truths, the most dangerous thing there are. These men are apparently very sincere. You would think they prayed about this. They really think Moses and Aaron have usurped too much authority, or doing too much in God's name, or taking too much on themselves. There's going to be a real surprise coming up. Now, Moses heard this. He fell on his face. Now, Moses has fallen on his face several times because of the blasphemous remarks of his people. Apparently, Moses falling on his face is a sign of reverence, a sign of shock at what's been said, a sign of the rebellion of the people of God. And he falls on his face as an intercessor to keep God from destroying them, apparently. Now he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, "Tomorrow morning the Lord will show who he is, and who is holy, and who he will bring near to himself, even the one whom he has chosen." You see, these men up there were chosen by the assembly, but God's going to show who he chose, and that's the one that's really going to count. Now, let's go to verse 6. "Do this, take censers for yourself, Korah and all your company." Now we're going to read down through here that there was 250 men are going to apparently approach the Lord with these censers. Now that seems to relate to the 250 tribal leaders, but I'm not sure. This count has some ambiguity in it. There seems to be at least two groups, Korah and those who wanted to be priests, and Reuben and those who just wanted other tribal leader, another leader than Moses. Exactly how this relates is somewhat uncertain. Now these censers were a kind of a fire pan. They were made out of bronze, we learn later. You put incense in them with some coals from the altar of sacrifice, and the incense would bellow up. Now, I don't know where they got all these censers. Maybe every man had his own censer to cook with or something. I don't know. Maybe they hastily made these censers, but they didn't have this many censers for the priest. And there are going to be 250 men come offer incense before the Lord. Now, folks, this is one serious deal that Moses is going to say to them to do. Because I'm sure it was etched in their memory what happened back in Leviticus chapter 10, where Nadab and Abihu approached the Lord with strange fire, and fire came out from the presence of the Lord and killed them. What Moses is saying, you want to see who God chooses? It may cost you your life. Get you a censer. You put some fire, some coals in it. You put some incense on it, and you come stand before the Lord, and the Lord will choose. Now, these men are apparently very sincere. They're putting their life on the line, believing that God has not chosen only Aaron to lead the people. This is not obviously who's right and who's wrong in the sense of motive. But God is going to judge these men. And I think you'll see that. They were rebelling against God's chosen leadership, who they had seen. They had seen God talking to Moses through this, even this short time at Mount Sinai. They knew who God chose. But they're frustrated about this historical situation, and they're going to rebel against God's leaders. Notice in verse 10, I think, by the way, they're going to put this in, they're going to approach the tabernacle. And he brought you near, Korah, and all of your brothers, sons of Levi, with you, and you are seeking for the priesthood also, verse 10. And that seemed to be the motive behind Korah, though we can't be sure. Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. Notice that opposing God's leaders are opposing God. There's some real New Testament passages on this about grieve those who serve you in God's name. And boy, I have mixed emotions about this. I have known of occasions where I thought God's men, God's leaders, did some very inappropriate things in God's name, had bad attitudes, made some bad decisions. On the other hand, I've seen God's people in churches have been ugly, vindictive, not willing followers of obvious leaders of God. You have to take almost every case on its own merit. There's obviously sincere feelings on both sides. Just because, quote, you're a called man of God doesn't mean you're always right. But, friends, there's always a respect due to the office. Sometimes we disagree with the President of the United States, but there's a respect due to the office. There's a respect due to God's called leaders. I think we ought to see that. Now, notice in verse 12 where it says, "Then Moses sent a summons to Dathan and Abiram. Now, these are the leaders of the tribe of Reuben, and Moses wanted them to come. Apparently, the same meeting where he talked to Korah. But they wouldn't come. They said, "We'll not come up. Is it not enough, number one, that you have brought us out of the land flowing with milk and honey?" What are they talking about? Egypt. My word, the good old days were the pits. But our mind tends to accentuate what we want it to remember. They're talking about the land of slavery, the land of making bricks, the taskmasters of Egypt, as a land flowing with milk and honey. Oh my, what an exaggeration. And number two, to have us die in the wilderness. Has not God provided their every need? Provided water, provided food, provided everything? This is a rebellion against God's promise to what He's going to do for them. Look at number three. But you would lord it over us, implying that Moses was not giving God's word, but Moses was acting on his own. Indeed, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor have you given us an inheritance of fields and vineyards. Now, what's he talking about? They're still frustrated over not being able to enter the promised land because of their unbelief at the report of the 10 negative spies. And God said, you're going to wander 40 years and all of you are going to die in the wilderness. Now, they've turned away from Kadesh. They've headed back toward the Red Sea. And now they're griping about it. They're grumbling about it. They're mad at Moses. They're implying that it's Moses' fault they didn't enter the promised land instead of their own unbelief. Now, notice it says, would you put eyes out of these men? Now, that some people say this is linked to gouging out the eyes of runaway slaves. It seems in context to imply, would you stop our complaints? Maybe putting out the eyes is a metaphor for you don't want us to see the problems of your leadership. I'm not really sure. I don't know this idiom in Hebrew. We will not come up. Do you sense the rebellion of these people, these two families of the Reubenites? Then Moses became very angry. There was a half-truth in what they said. I'm sure Moses was frustrated the people of God could enter the promised land. I think he was frustrated that they had to wander 40 years. And now that may be coming out in his reaction. I think it's obviously that he overreacted against this group. Do not regard their offering. Now, this seems to involve, I don't think they're offering anything at the temple at this point, or tabernacle, excuse me. I think what Moses is saying is, God, don't regard them. Don't listen to their prayers. Don't accept their sacrifice. Lord, they're rebelling against me, and by rebelling against me, they're rebelling against you. Lord, don't listen to what they're saying. I think that's what it is. Don't have compassion on them. I have not taken a single donkey from them, nor have I done them any harm. Moses is basically saying, I haven't been a rough leader. I haven't confiscated their goods. I haven't run roughshod over them. I haven't taken their property, stole their things. They're impugning my motives for no reason, is what Moses is saying here. And Moses said to Korah, now he's back on to Korah, you and all your company be present before the Lord tomorrow. What would that be? In the tabernacle. Both you and they along with Aaron. So it's going to be these apparently 250 men we're going to see from verse 17 and Korah. And then apparently these sons of Reuben are going to stay at their tents. Now there is some confusion between here because it never says that Korah stays with these 250 men with censers. It may be implied, but it doesn't say that. Matter of fact, later on in Numbers 26, it seems to imply that the ground swallowed Korah, which means he must have left the tabernacle and went and stood with the two sons of Reuben. I'm just not sure. Each of you take his fire pan, put incense on it. Each of you bring his censer before the Lord, 250 fire pans. Also, you and Aaron shall each bring his fire pan. Now, the 250 here, if I look for another 250, I go back to verse 2 for the other tribal leaders. Were these tribal leaders trying to be priests? Did they want to be priests along with Korah? Are these the family of Korah here, other Levites? I'm just not sure. It's either two groups of 250 or it's the same group. And that's what I can't be sure from this. They brought their fire. They came and Korah assembled all the congregation against them. Implication is that Korah had quite a following among the people of God. All of the people of God came to the tabernacle. Now, there's so many of them. I'm sure they must have stood around and tried to look over the curtain, maybe on a little ridge or anything that was available. They're watching this procedure. And the glory of the Lord appeared to all the congregation. The word glory is the word kabod. It means something that's weighty. It's a commercial term originally, but it came to mean something weighty and therefore valuable. And here it expresses the glory of the Lord. I think it's the Shekinah cloud that was during the wilderness wandering period that symbolized the angel of the Lord with the people of God. Then Yahweh spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, "Separate yourselves from this congregation, that I may consume them instantly." But they fell on their faces. Who? Moses and Aaron. Now, did God really want to start over with Moses? There's a possibility, yes. You see, he tried to work with Adam, but it failed. And then again, he tried to work with Noah, and it, you know, failed. And later on, he's going to come back to work with Abraham, and it failed. It might be possible. He's going to say, "Moses, I'm going to start over you." But most theologians say this was a test for Moses more than God wanting to start over. Well, if it is, Moses had this test several times, for he has had to intercede for this people several times just like this to keep from God from starting over with him. The first time at the golden calf experience, God made this offer at Exodus 32, 9 and 10. He makes this offer again right here in Numbers 16. He made this offer earlier in Numbers 14, 11 and 12, and he'll make this same offer again in verse 45. Moses fell on his face and he said, "O Elohim, Thou Elohim of the spirits of all flesh." Now, some have tried to build a big theology here about where the souls come from and all. You can't do that. You can't force the Bible into a doctrine book when primarily it's a relationship book. All Moses is saying is, "You're the God of all that's living." The word spirit here is basically the Hebrew word ruah, which can mean breath, wind, or spirit. In Genesis 2:7, it's that which animates the man made out of clay. It's the same word that used, I think, the life-giving force of God. He's just saying, "You're the controller of all that lives because you're the only source of life." That's what the word Yahweh means, the ever-living, only-living God. God is the only one that has life, and He chooses to give it. When one man sins, will thou be angry with the entire congregation? Now, this is my opinion, this is the incipient or beginning emphasis of the tension between individual accountability and responsibility and corporate accountability and responsibility. In the Bible, there's a tension between a man is responsible for a group. Remember when Achan sinned his whole family died and Israel's army lost the next day because of Achan's sin? Here, these men, these leaders are going to rebel and all of their families are going to die with them. There's something of that corporality. Adam sinned and all men fell in Adam. There is certainly that in the Bible. But there is beginning, even in the Old Testament, which becomes magnified in the New Testament, this emphasis, if I can put it crudely, on every tub sits on its own bottom. Everybody is responsible for his own acts. I think it's very clearly laid out in the New Covenant of Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34, and even more specifically in Ezekiel chapter 18, and then I think the New Testament's main thrust is individual responsibility. Moses is saying, "God, you won't kill all the people for just a few people's sins, will you?" And I think God begins to say, "No." It's almost reminiscent of Abraham's argument with God about Sodom and Gomorrah. Same basic idea. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the congregation, saying, get back from around the dwellings of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." Now here it seems that Korah has somehow come to be with these other two tribes. I mean, he left the people in the temple with their fire pans and went to stand with these family of Reuben. I just don't know. Or it's just Korah's family by themselves without him there. Then Moses arose and went to Dathan and Abiram, the elders of Israel, following him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, "Depart from the tents of these wicked men and touch nothing that belongs to them." This touching nothing that belongs to them is a key to understanding that these men had become separated to God. They had become, in a sense, the recipients of holy war. They couldn't touch anything in Jericho, as you know, later on. They couldn't touch anything of these men. All their property, including their family, their cattle, everything belongs to God, here for judgment. And so they are to move back. And of course, as you know, Moses says down here in verse 30, God's going to do an entirely new thing to prove to you that I'm God's call leader. He says, if these men live a natural lifespan and die a natural death, I am not God's servant. But if God does a new thing, now it's hard to translate this because it's the word bara, usually used for the creative power of the spoken word. Here, my translation says, it's going to create an entirely new thing, bring about an entirely new thing. The ground is going to open up. Now, for those who try to find a natural mechanism for this, some have said this is a mud flat thing where the ground is thin and it sometimes caves in. There's a possibility that's true, but the supernatural timing and geographical extent of this is what's supernatural, as well as, I think, the ground opening, because it's just going to include the tents and families of the rebels. And that's all. Notice it says in verse 3, take them alive into Sheol. Now, Sheol is the holding place of the dead. It's viewed as being in the ground. You say, well, that just shows the Bible's not true because we've dug holes down there and nobody's there. Now, listen to me. The Old Testament is basically the language of description. As the smoke went up to God, they believed that God was up. But we know from our space exploration that God is not up. He's everywhere. I think heaven's a place, but I don't know whether it's up, down, or what, because I know the earth is upside down at times and stuff. So what I say to you is that the Bible describes a three-storied universe, but that is not trying to give theology about creation. That's the way it is. It's trying to describe. Because where do the Jews put their dead? The Jews, like our culture, bury their dead. So where would the dead be? In the ground. So it's the language of description, not the language of a scientific fact. But Sheol is an interesting study. It's usually personified as a grave that's under the ground that is eating the people. Now, when they went speaking, everything fell into the ground and swallowed them up. And then, at the same time, fire came out from the presence of the Lord in verse 35, just as it had in Leviticus 10. For Nadab and Abihu, fire came out and killed all of those 250 who had that strange fire before the Lord. God manifested His will in choosing Aaron, just as He had done earlier when He showed His holiness, and nobody but the Levites and the priests could approach God without causing the death of some people. And here, that same thing is proved true again. Now, and notice that God speaks to Eleazar, that's Aaron's son, who's going to become priest, and has him to collect these fire pans, these bronze ones. Why? The very fact they were close to God made them holy, and they couldn't be put back in normal use. Now, what's going to be done is they're going to make a bronze covering for the altar of sacrifice. Now, we learned back in the book of Exodus, where we described the altar of sacrifice, that it also had a bronze, already had a bronze covering. Some say this is the new bronze covering, the old is taken off. I doubt that, because the old would be holy too. I think it was an extra layer of bronze put on the altar. Now, what's the purpose of that extra layer of bronze? Well, the thing was holy. It couldn't be used. And look in verse 38. This shall be a sign to the sons of Israel. Look down in verse 40. And the remainder of the sons of Israel, that no layman or his descendants, except the descendants of Aaron, shall approach and burn incense. Now, here it's the idea of this is to be a memorial. The fact that God acted in history and judged these people was to be a deterrent in the future from other people acting that way. I think the judgment of God works that way. God shows us who He is by what He does. Sometimes what He does seems very cruel, but it's meant to teach numerous generations the truth about God and who He is. Now, let's see. And all the congregation, the sons of Israel, grumbled against Moses and Aaron. My soul, I can't believe verse 41. God's just wiped the earth's open up and destroyed this group that rebelled. The fire's come out from the Lord and killed this group that rebelled. And now all the congregation is griping again at Moses and Aaron. You don't know what the time factor is in here, but it's right next to each other. It can't be very long. There's an undercurrent of grumbling all the way through Numbers. People are just rebelling in their attitude against God because God is not doing it their way. And so now they're going to take these poles from every tribe, put them before the Lord. God's going to show again His choice of leadership of Moses and Aaron, and by this almond rod that's going to bud. And this almond rod is going to be Aaron's rod, right? And that's what we're going to have in chapter 17. Now, it does mention here that the latter part of number 16, the people are going to grumble. God's going to get sick of it. Aaron and Moses, instead of falling on their face this time, they're going to know that punishment has already gone out from God. And so Moses tells Aaron, get your censer, the approved official censer, get you some incense in it and run and try to stop this plague. It's the only place in the Bible that incense acts as atonement. Apparently a plague broke out on some part of the camp. I would assume on the south, but I'm not sure because all the tribes were griping. And Aaron had to run and stand between where the plague had come and those who were still alive. It shows the effectiveness of Aaron's ministry. It's in a very powerful metaphor for God accepting Aaron as priest, standing between sin and the people. And so it's almost like a very vivid metaphor of the effective and efficacious ministry of Aaron. And then again, the people, to show that for certain that God picked Aaron, they all get a rod, for one for every of the 12 tribes, not the Levites, of course. Aaron would stand for the Levites. Some say that it was the tribe of Joseph here, where you get 12, I'm not sure. And wrote the name of the tribe on it, put it before the Ark of the Covenant in apparently the Holy of Holies, or at least in front of the veil in the holy place. And the rod that blossoms, that will be God's choice. Next day they brought the rods out. One rod had leaves and buds and almonds. Almond was the first plant to bloom. And here it was Aaron's. This thing became holy too. They had to put it back before the ark. Some say they put this inside the ark along with the manna and the broken tablets that Moses broke on the golden calf experience. Others say it was before the ark or beside the ark. I'm not real sure. But again, it does show God's choice of these people. Let's go down to the end of chapter 17. Then the sons of Israel spoke to Aaron, saying, "Behold, we perish. We are dying. We are all dying. Everyone who comes near the tabernacle of the Lord must die. Are we to perish completely?" Now, this seems to be a reaction to the plague that's come and killed some of them. The ground's opened up with Korah. They're scared. God's so holy, He's a frightening God. They were afraid of Him on Mount Sinai. Now He's in the midst of their camp, and thousands of them are dying. They're saying, "What are we going to do?" And Moses is saying, "Look, listen to me now. I've chosen a group of men to stand before me, to come close to me in a unique way for you. If you'll just trust the men that I've appointed, you won't die. But if you come close to me, and you're not one of the Levites or priests, you're going to die. Because I'm holy and you're sinful. I've appointed you a procedure, sacrifice, feast days, Day of Atonement. I've provided you a procedure to keep yourself clean so that I may be holy in your midst. But when you rebel against me, my holiness can be destructive." And apparently that's what this is. And so Moses is saying, "You have the Levites, you have the priest. Follow my procedures and all will be well." And that again shows this. I guess the book of Numbers is characterized by the gripey people of God. Maybe men haven't changed. Watch your attitude. I've enjoyed being with you. God bless you. Have a good day.